today we are looking at Africa, something which I always think we don't do enough, because I think it is one of those areas that is becoming increasingly important in terms of international affairs and the way that the world that I call the network world is developing. And we've set as usual a question, Africa, a continent whose time has come, that was, I think, a title we set. I always say this because last year, some of you may remember, Chris Patton got up and accused us of setting a ridiculous question. I didn't dare say publicly he had actually set the question himself in order to be able to knock it down. But we've got a very distinguished panel today. I'm going to ask each of them to speak for 10 minutes and then give them a chance, if they need to pick up points from each other, and then I'll open it up to the floor. As usual, we will finish dead on 2 o'clock, because I always make that a rule. I know some of you otherwise begin to disappear, and there's nothing more disconcerting for speakers than to see their audience drifting away at the end of a session. So I'm going to ask them to speak for 10 minutes each. I'm going to start with, I'll introduce them all now, with Dr. Knox Chitiyo. He is a Zimbabwean researcher. He was the first RUSI Nelson Mandela Visiting African Fellow, and he now heads the RUSI Africa Programme. He was a senior lecturer in war studies in the history department at the University of Zimbabwe between 1994 and 2003. And he's also the deputy director and co-founder of the Center for Defense Studies during the same period, and edited the Journal of African Security and Conflict. And there are many other things I could tell you about him, but I hope you'll feel that I've said enough. I'm then going to call on Dr. Richard Cockett, who's the Africa editor at The Economist. He worked previously, before he went to The Economist, as a journalist. He was a British Academy junior research fellow and lecturer in history and politics at the University of London. But he's here today particularly because he recently returned from the Sudan, where he was covering their first multi-party election in 25 years, which forms the last chapter of his new book, Sudan, Darfur and the Failure of an African State, which is on sale at the back of the room if afterwards you want to buy one, and I'm sure if you do that he will sign it for you. So there's the plug that I'm sure you would welcome. And last but certainly not least, my colleague when I was a Member of Parliament and my friend, Tony Baldry. He's been a Member of Parliament for 27 years. He was a minister under both Margaret Thatcher and John Major. Under the latter, he was the Parliamentary Under Secretary of State at the Foreign Commonwealth Office, where his responsibilities included, among others, Africa. And he was, during the 2001 to 2005 Parliament, he chaired the Select Committee on International Development. And he continues to take a close interest in international development and foreign affairs. And he is also the chairman of the Conservative Party's Human Rights Commission. So I'll be calling them in that order. But I'm delighted they were all able to be with us here today. So I'm going to start, as I say, with Dr. Knox Chitiyo. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to speak in front of such a distinguished audience. I'll just try and give a sort of overview, my perspectives, if you like, on Africa now and Africa's future, and how we see ourselves, I think, as Africans. First off, I think Africa's time has come, I feel. In a variety of ways, I think we are now seeing, particularly over the last 5 years or more, that Africa has very much now become part of the international system. Africa is no longer a passive player in the global system, the global economy, the global politics, global security issues. Things are no longer simply being done to Africa. I think we're seeing an age now of African internationalism, particularly over the last few years, where Africa, apart from trying to improve its own prospects within the continent, is also becoming more and more engaged in the global system, in global politics, in the global economy, and in the global security system. And this, I think, is a result of what we may also see as a new age of multipolarity. We're seeing here, I think, in a sense, the relative decline of the West We hear a lot of talk about the West versus the rest and so on and so forth. The decline, I think, is relative. I don't think we can say that the United States or the UK or the EU are now finished as global players. That's not what it's about. But there is the perception, and perception is everything. There is the perception that there is a relative decline by the United States in the global system, the UK and Europe as well. They are no longer seen as the key or the ultimate stakeholders or makers of the global system. They are now simply players amongst other players. We've seen the rise of Asia, we've seen the rise of the BRIC countries, and now I think we're seeing the rise of Africa as well. Africa, I think, has emerged and is emerging as a, in a sense, a global counterweight, a global anchor within the system. So I think in many ways this is the time for Africa. Africa has, I think, moved into the 21st century. We're now talking of 21st century Africa. I think the way we used to think of Africa as sort of post-colonial, post-independence Africa, I think for me, post-colonial, post-independence Africa, that kind of idea is dead. We've now moved into 21st century Africa with, some of the issues still remain, but I think we're seeing a new kind of energy for Africa, which is emerging. There's a new confidence. Africa is an actor on the world stage in terms of foreign policy. We saw just this year at the AU meeting in January, we saw that Croatia and Serbia became involved when they asked the AU, in a sense, to mediate on their issues. This is just one example of the way in which Africa and Africans are being courted by the world community for their views on non-African issues. So the internationalism of Africa, I think, is something which is very, very important. There's talk that perhaps Africa will have a permanent seat at the UN Security Council. So these are very, very important things. And again, we'd say Africa has now reached an age, I think, of assertive diplomacy, where it is recognized as a major player, particularly in the global political system. Also, if we look at security, again, African security is no longer seen only in terms of the security in Africa. There's an international dimension as well to African security. We see African peacekeepers being engaged in various parts of the world, and even being courted by the Middle East to mediate in Middle Eastern disputes. Internally, in terms of security, and these are some of the positive things, I think we're seeing Africa is really, really trying to develop and improve the internal security institutions within the continent. We've seen the development of the African standby forces, their moves to improve African policing, African training of armies is improving all the time. So the professionalization of African military and security is, I think, something which is an important development, and that there is an awareness that this needs to be done. And we've also seen, again, as I say, Africa getting more involved in global security issues, small arms issues, even in the nuclear debate. Africa is now involved in these kind of issues. In governance, again, if we look both internally and externally, we've seen some breakthroughs. There's certainly a lot of outstanding issues, and I will speak on that for a little bit later on. But I think we've seen some breakthroughs. Africa has taken a stand on issues of governance. Military takeovers have been outlawed by the AU, and sanctions have been put on coup leaders, which is something which wasn't really happening during the time of the old Organization for African Unity. So Africa and the AU, I think, are taking governance issues much more seriously, because there's an awareness that governance is directly linked to development. You cannot really have the one without the other. So there is that kind of progress. So security institutions are being improved, training of leadership and so on and so forth is happening as well. Also, I think we're seeing a wave of constitutionalism within Africa, and a great number of African countries are reviewing their constitutions. They're preparing for elections. So we're seeing a kind of, if you like, a third wave of constitutionalism within Africa. If you like, the first wave, I think, would have been immediately preceding independence, when African countries inherited the colonial constitutions that were there. The second wave, perhaps, was immediately after the after the Cold War ended, when there was the great development of multi-partyism. And now I think we're seeing a third wave of constitutionalism, where there's so much interest in reviewing constitutions, how long should leaders be in power for, and this kind of thing, I think, is very, very strong, and it strengthens, I think, Africa's institutions. It's not necessarily a neat process. In many ways, it's a very messy process, but I think it's good that it's happening, that constitutionalism in Africa is happening. And also, we're also seeing a wave of coalition governments. 4 or 5 years ago, as a Zimbabwean, I remember when our governor of national unity took power in Zimbabwe, there was a lot of criticism, particularly from some quarters in the West, about, you know, how terrible it is, power sharing and coalition, which debases democracy and so on and so forth. But I think, having looked around, what we're seeing is that some of the coalition governments actually have acted as entry points for reform, for political reform, for constitutional reform. It's not all bad by any man of means. Admittedly, it's not particularly all great either, but I think what we're seeing is coalition governments and power sharing in Africa has emerged as a useful conduit to political reform. Not to mention, of course, that here in the UK we see that there's coalition government as well, so it may be that there are things, discussions we should be having between Africa and the UK on coalitions as well. In terms of economic growth, I think we've seen tremendous economic growth. Some of it, of course, has been stunted a little bit by the economic recession, but overall, over the past decade, Africa has averaged 4 to 5% economic growth, which is pretty good. And perhaps more importantly, we are seeing the development of a middle class, a sustainable middle class in Africa. The informal sector remains highly resilient, and it's been one of the things which has helped to pull Africa through this economic recession. Also, we have seen the rise of a relatively small but highly competent and professional formal sector. I think Africa's financial institutions actually are pretty strong, and it's one of the reasons I think that Africa has survived the recession. You haven't had the massive financial collapses across Africa that you've had elsewhere in the world. Admittedly, yes, in certain countries, for instance, in Nigeria, yes, the banks, there was a problem where the banks did have to be bailed out by the state. But overall, if you look across the continent, Africa's financial institutions have done pretty well. And I don't think the reason can purely be linked to the fact that we have relatively small economies and so on and so forth. It may well be that Africa's financial institutions are actually better managed than elsewhere and have survived better because the management is better. Because, as I say, we have a class now of technocrats, of very professional people who are running these institutions very, very well. So I think it's something to think about. Then also the diaspora, I think, has played a key role and will continue to play a key role in Africa. I think the diaspora should be seen in many ways as an outer Africa. What I think the recession will do, and what it is doing, is to improve the links between the African diaspora and Africa. Because, of course, a lot of people
in the diaspora are now out of work because of the recession, and they're turning back to Africa. So in a sense, the recession is helping Africa. I'll just put one or two other points before I close. There are still challenges. Yes, I think it is Africa's time, but this is not to underplay the challenges. The challenges of poverty remain. I think Africa's internationalism has to be co-managed and complemented by attention to social inequality. Poverty remains a huge problem, and we have to get to grips with that issue. There's issues around corruption, which remain. Issues around impunity, which we still have to deal with. I think the Kampala discussion with the ICC is something of a breakthrough with regards to impunity, with regards to justice, social justice, and so on and so forth. Security, again, is another issue. And, of course, there's the question of aid, which I think my colleagues will take up more on. But overall, as I say, I think this is Africa's time. And as Africans, we need, I think, to seize the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for what was a fine day with you, and very grateful for that. We're going to slightly narrow down now, I think, a little. I'm going to ask Dr. Richard Cockey to speak to us.
Thank you very much, Michael. Yes, I'm going to narrow down now and look at Sudan as a kind of case study of some themes that have already been discussed. And I'm going to cop out terribly here and answer to your question, Africa, a continent whose time has come. Yes, but in many respects, no. I see a much more ambivalent picture than what's just gone before, which I will now explain. And I think Sudan's a good country to talk about in this context, because Sudan is Africa's largest country, and it also, within it, it's a very complex country with a rich history, but it also contains within it many of the great issues, subjects, themes that are important in Africa today. And to start with, I just want to outline why I think Sudan is encouraging. It shows many of the positive aspects of Africa's progress today. But then I want to also look at the flip side and show how sometimes those very advantages turn out to be severe disadvantage. Fissures, cracks in the facade of the country, which may indeed make it break up within the next 6 months. Because as many as you probably know, there's a referendum on the secession of South Sudan, which is due to take place in January 2011. And if the southern Sudanese vote yes to secession, which I am about 99% certain they will, then the country will break up, and we will, if we were came back in a year's time, we will be discussing the future of an entire new country, which will probably be called South Sudan, Africa's first new country since Eritrea in the early 1990s. Now, to begin with the economy, as we've just said, Africa in the 2000s enjoyed, in fact, pretty robust growth compared to the rest of the world. Sudan was a very, in many ways, spectacular example of that. Africa was averaging about 5.5% growth. Sudan would hit 8%, 9% during the years about 2004 to 2008, before the financial crash. And most of this, in fact, almost all of this economic growth was based on oil. It was a commodity boom, but again, Sudan very illustrative of a continental-wide trend on Africa cashing in on the thirst for natural resources, not only oil, but copper, etc. And most of that demand came from China and the East, feeding the rise of the Asian economies. It's a familiar story. China, Malaysia, and India formed a consortium that now exploited most of Sudan's oil, and China buys about 95% of it. So really, Sudan has risen, the Sudanese economy has risen on this great tidal, this wave of Asian success, Asian advancement, the great phenomenon of the last 10 years. And Sudan, like Africa, has reap great advantage from that. Secondly, in terms of a more peaceful continent, a more stable continent. The Economist wrote a famous cover, is responsible for a famous cover, which already I see some of you smiling, remembering what it is. It was called The Hopeless Continent, which was published in 2000. And the point of that cover was to illustrate the fact that at that time there were civil wars, conflict, wars between states raging across virtually the whole of the continent, west to east, north to south, going from Liberia, Sierra Leone, the Niger Delta, Niger, across, you know, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia had already collapsed and down, Zimbabwe, etc., etc. Since then, of course, the picture's much better. There are less civil wars. Many of those awful civil wars have been put down. Sudan, again, a very good, very good example of this. The 2005 peace agreement ended pretty well 50 years of on-off civil war between the north, the Islamist North Sudan, and the mainly Christian and animist South Sudan. That war was, at the time, Africa's longest-running civil war, and it cost about 2.5 million lives and made about 6 million homeless, and it devastated the South. So bringing that war to an end was a huge success. 4 or 5 years of tough negotiations, mainly pushed through by the United States. I call it George Bush's only foreign policy success. Others here may disagree. And then in April this year, there were elections, the first elections since 1986, the first multi-party elections since 1986, widely monitored. Many people there to cover them, including me. Lots of donor countries putting quite a lot of money to make sure they were a success. And to a degree, to a small degree, I think they probably were. There was a small democratic opening, and in the north and certainly in the south, they were pretty well run, and there was sort of open expression of opinion. And again, that is largely in line with some promising signs in Africa of a democratic opening, of more and more elections being held, more and more participation of civil society, etc. So that's a positive. But I think also Sudan, unfortunately, is a very good example of all the negatives going on at the same time. And to begin with, the economy and oil. I mean, Sudan has benefited a lot from the oil boom, but who in Sudan specifically has benefited from that oil boom? I would say not many people. In fact, a small elite around Khartoum. And because of that, because the oil wealth have been so concentrated and spent so much on the centre of the country, and particularly on weapons and armaments, mainly for the army to fight their wars, it means that the wealth has not been shared out. And in fact, the influx of wealth has created more inequality in the country, which has made the peripheries even more resentful of the wealth of the centre. So I would argue that, in fact, the increase in wealth of a small amount of people in Sudan has made the country less stable, not more stable. And that fuels the war in Darfur, for instance, where Darfuris are still very angry about their lack of development, the lack of resources they have, as against the huge development projects, new dams, roads, etc., mostly built by the Chinese, which are now taking place in the centre of the country. So it's not wealth per se, it's how you distribute it, what you use with it. War and peace, yes, there was the peace agreement in 2005, but during the negotiations for that war broke out in Darfur, 2003. The death toll there has been less than the North-South Civil War, but still awful, probably 300,000 killed as a result of the conflict. That's a UN figure, and 3 million people made homeless. That's pretty well half the population of Darfur. That conflict is ongoing. There were signs that there might be some peace talks earlier this year. They've broken down, and the two sides have gone back to conflict. The latest figures that there were 200 people killed last month. So I'm afraid there's still not countrywide peace in Sudan. And in South Sudan, is also there's increases in inter-ethnic violence, inter-tribal violence in South Sudan, which makes the prospect of South Sudan as an independent country quite worrying because of the increase there. And lastly, for accountability and legitimacy, yes, there were elections. Yes, they were the first elections since 1986. But I thought they were a charade. The international observers were rather kinder. The Carter Centre and the EU both called them below the standards expected of elections, below international standards. They were being very polite. I think it was rigged well in advance in the north. And the south, although I think the polling mechanism was fairer, there was quite a lot of intimidation and thuggery by the ruling party there, the SPLA, which I must say augurs, it's quite ominous for future developments in that part of the country as well. So again, that proves the old adage that it's all very well having elections, but they're not really important or significant unless they take place against a background of a general improvement in human rights, freedom of assembly, freedom of the media, freedom of parties to express themselves and organise. As many as you will probably know, in the north of Sudan, almost all the opposition parties in fact boycotted the elections because they felt the conditions for free and fair elections did not exist. So I'll end there, but just by summing up that, you know, I'm afraid Sudan points in positive directions, but those same areas we've discussed also point in very negative directions. And unless a country like Sudan, Africa's biggest, grapples very firmly and properly with these problems in the future, I don't think the country is going to improve very much, despite all the advantages of the past 10 years.
Thank you very much. Finally, on our panel, I'm now going to call on Tony Baldry, MP.
Well, following on from Richard's comments, I sometimes say to my children, I have no fear of death. I have been to hell. They are called Gaza and Darfur, because it's, I think, hard to think of or imagine anywhere that can be more terrible than the conditions in which people are living in Darfur. I'm very impressed by the extent to which Michael is now taking the coalition, meeting in the Lloyd George room in the National Liberal Club. I think this is highly commendable, and I suspect next time the meeting will be in the Gladstone room, and I think this is, you know, and I'm slightly apprehensive about making any comments in the presence of a former very distinguished Foreign Secretary and a former very distinguished Shadow Foreign Secretary, but here goes. Firstly, I think that the UK needs to have a foreign policy for Africa. In other words, a policy which is emanates from the Foreign Office in addition to anything that comes from DFID. The Foreign Office spends about has a budget of about £2 billion and is going to have to make cuts of about at least a quarter. So that's half £1 billion out of a £2 billion budget. And, you know, Foreign Office has responsibility also for the BBC World Service and the British Council. And when you have an office which is essentially about people and buildings, that doesn't give you very much scope. You've either got to chop embassies or substantially reduce staff. And so whatever happens, it's going to be very painful, I suspect. So far as Africa is concerned, I think that we ought to focus on the C in FCO, which is Commonwealth. I think the Commonwealth is a real mutual asset for every member of the Commonwealth, and I think that we should focus our efforts on the Commonwealth and on Commonwealth countries. I mean, just bringing up Richard's comments, I don't think that we've had any or very little diplomatic traction in the Sudan, and I think if we're going to invest time, energy and effort, we should do that with Commonwealth colleagues in Africa. And then I think we should develop a foreign policy, which I think actually, I think there's been a sort of tension whereby in foreign policy we've had UK high commissioners, again quite rightly, talking to partners about such things as good governance, whilst the Chinese have been coming through the other door, not interested at all in good governance, but just signing up for all the iron ore, mineral rights, other deals, and I think, as you were saying, we now just be seen as another player because, you know, if you're being confronted with a mini lecture from the UK High Commissioner on the one hand about good governance, and here's another guy coming through the door offering you loads of wonga in exchange for some oil concessions, where it's a bit of a no-brainer as to who you're going to spend most of the time with. So in working out our foreign policy in Africa, I think we have to have some regard to those realities. Then in relation to DFID, now to put DFID into context with the Foreign Office, DFID has £8 billion, I think, its budget this year, and it is ring-fenced. However, and I think we ought to recognise that the UK is already spending 0.6% of GDP on international development. We are by far and away the furthest ahead of all the G8 countries on our commitment to the 0.7 target, which I'm sure we'll reach by 2013. I think the first thing we have to do there, I think we have to make sure that the other G8 countries start to get somewhere near what we're doing, and surprisingly the three worst performers are the United States, Japan and Russia. But even European colleagues such as Italy are not doing particularly well. But then it seems to me that we have a choice. A lot of attention, quite rightly, between now and 2015 will be focused on trying to meet the Millennium Development Goals. But the risk of that is that we just simply go around Africa and elsewhere dishing out checks for health, education and good governance. And there is no creative tension in that at all. And I think that what we ought to be doing in ensuring that we get best value for the money that we put in is that we ought to be doing this increasingly on a challenge fund type basis. In some places, investing money in health, education and governance will be good news. But in other places, it seems to me that we need to be encouraging jobs, enterprise, economic growth. When I was chairing the Select Committee, pretty well wherever we went, after a while the question we would ask ourselves is, where are the jobs going to come from? Where is the employment? And unless we can see the economies of African countries growing, and of course they have to grow particularly fast to take account of the population growth very often, unless we can see that happening, we will forever be giving money for education, health and good governance. So I think in some instances we ought to be more willing to allow either governments or NGOs or other entities to put in bids, providing they meet the DAC criteria, for funding for projects which would tend to lead to employment, to microfinance, to jobs, and economic growth. And so one can actually see a tension, and you can see how our money is doing, how our international development is doing in one country compared with what it's producing in another country. For a while there was this kind of dispute between budget aid and project finance, and for a while there was the kind of thought that all that we would do would be to give financial support to the treasurers of various African states, and they would just get on with it, and that was rather undermined by what happened in Ethiopia. But I think with a general public which is becoming increasingly questioning about whether we should be ring-fencing international development, whether we should be spending so much on international development, I think we need to be able to demonstrate beyond peradventure that the money that we are spending is being spent in the best possible way. And I think that will have to, and can only be demonstrated, if we have something of a mixed economy in the way in which we invest our international development money. It just doesn't simply all go on health, education and governance. Also, I think that we're going to need to be able to much more clearly demonstrate the outcomes of the money that we're spending. HIV/AIDS is a terrible curse for Africa, and quite rightly, over the years, we have invested an enormous amount of money in HIV/AIDS. But whenever you meet an HIV AIDS NGO, if one asks them if they can demonstrate the outcomes of all this investment in terms of reduction of infection rates or reduction of actual cases of HIV/AIDS, answer comes there, none. And I think it's getting to a point where it is intellectually and politically really difficult to continue to justify investing large sums of money in projects where people cannot demonstrate that the money you're putting in at one end is actually having a successful outcome at the other end. So, you know, if Africa is a continent whose time has come, it has to be two things, doesn't it? On the one hand, yes, of course, continuing to invest in civil society, but also equally as important is ensuring that Africa grows economically. And if it doesn't grow economically simply because China happens to be investing money today in Africa, because the simple truth is this, with all due respect to Chinese friends, that once the iron ore has been dug out of Mauritania, or the cobalt from Zimbabwe, or some other mineral from somewhere else, once that has gone, I don't think we see any indication of China making any long-term investment in Africa. Once it's gone, they will have gone as well. I think, and I would hope, that the UK would be in Africa with African partners and Commonwealth colleagues for the long term, and that means helping develop African enterprise, business, industry, jobs, so that Africa, as we go through the 21st century, can be truly self-sufficient.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Listening to Tony, I thought about a speech that was made recently by Bob Zelick of the World Bank, which he called the end of the third world. And one of the arguments he was making, and perhaps the panel might like to pick up on this, was that too often we, as an international community, give money to various African countries, which is used then to buy the commodities that they could make for themselves that are not making for themselves, and they buy it from us, and I say us, the West. And so it's really recycling money in that way. And the point he was making, particularly in Africa in relation to agriculture, was that women and agriculture in Africa, in most African states, has enormous potential. And that rather than us giving money to African countries to buy basic commodities of food and soap and so on, we should be investing in them producing that for themselves, because that not only produces the sort of return that Tony was talking about, but at the same time it produces something which is going to last on their behalf as well. So I thought it was an interesting speech, and the title, The End of the Third World, was quite an interesting and provocative title. So does anybody want to pick up any of the points made by each other or what I've just said?
Michael, can I just reinforce your point? Just to give a very straightforward example. Before the conflict, Sierra Leone used to be not just self-sufficient in rice, but Sierra Leone used to export rice. And after the conflict, I went to Sierra Leone, and I went down to South Sierra Leone, to Bonth, where they used to grow a lot of rice. And I was talking about how do we get rice production going again. And I said to people locally, well, look, I can't believe that we need an enormous amount of money to get rice production going again in Bonth. And this is a crop that you get a two-year crop from, so once we get it going, we get enough seed to keep it going. And so I said, if someone could just give me a straightforward business plan, I'll take this back to London, see if we can't raise the money to get rice production going again in Bonth. And it then became pretty quickly apparent that no one locally could write a business plan, because as a consequence of the conflict, anyone with any get up and go in Bonth had got up and gone to Freetown, and anyone with any get up and go in Freetown during the conflict had got up and come to Southwark. And so the effect of the conflict on Sierra Leone had been to deprive large parts of the country of leadership and entrepreneurial zeal and spirit. And, you know, sometimes we just forget, or tend to forget, the complexities of Africa, in that, you know, those sorts of conflicts scar for a very long time.
Anybody else want to pick up on what's been said?
Can I just pick up on your point on the UK and aid, which I think was very interesting? It seems to me that there's an opportunity here for the UK government, which hopefully they won't miss, which is to engage the wider public here in the UK on the issue of aid
and development. As an African, yes, I mean, we'd be very happy if the UK doesn't cut its aid. But I think in terms of the UK taxpayer and so on and so forth, if other sectors are having their budgets cut, defense and so on and so forth, and we're talking of ring fencing aid, there's no real public debate on UK aid and development spending, I think there could be a public backlash. My suggestion would be, I think it would be perhaps useful to have a public debate, at least explain to the general public, why is the aid being ring-fenced? Why are we not cutting aid? Yes, we know, as you know, there's a moral imperative and there's other issues, but the wider public who are suffering in terms of recession here in the UK, I think it might be useful to the government to actually engage in a more public debate on that. And following up on that, and I think some of this has been hinted at in the Conservative and the Labour white paper on development. And picking up on that, it may be useful as well to engage with the diaspora, the African diaspora here in the UK, on the issues of aid and development. As I say, the diaspora here is getting more and more connected to Africa, partly because of the recession, partly because of business opportunities. I think you would be missing a great opportunity to talk to people who are influential as well. And then third, just on that as well, perhaps Africa itself needs a wider debate on the whole aid question. What does Africa want in terms of aid? I know it's a very differentiated continent, different countries want different things, but maybe it is also time for Africa to come up with a strategy on aid, since we are the ones who are the most affected by it.
I just want to take up one point on Tony Baldry, who said maybe we should concentrate our efforts more on Commonwealth countries in Africa or countries with the British links. I don't think that's a good idea, because what I see a lot in Africa actually in Commonwealth countries or countries with strong British links, Sudan being an excellent example, is the lingering resentment at us as the imperial aggressors, imperial oppressors. To us, all this is long in the long-distant past. To them, it's extremely recent history. In Zimbabwe, for instance, being one most obvious example for us. But there, these feelings are still very strong. I think it'd be much more interesting if we went to some countries where we could start with a clean slate, because we all would try and identify ourselves now as a country of good governance, EU model system, well funded elections, accountability, etc. This is often thrown back in our faces by countries, often quite rightly, who have experienced, or their fathers or grandfathers experienced none of that from us. So I would throw out as a suggestion, let's go to some places where we're not very well known and start preaching these things there. We might get a better reception.
Interesting thought. Now I'm going to open it up to the floor. Who would like to start?